Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we're previewing two musical theater productions. First, Carthage's production of The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which opens this weekend. And in part two of today's program, we'll preview UW Parkside's production of Stephen Sondheim's A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. Stay with us. This is an exceptionally busy weekend here in southeastern Wisconsin. And in addition to several different classical music offerings that are not to be missed, there's also two musical theater productions that are opening at our two colleges in town apart from Gateway. Carthage College is opening its production of The Mystery of Edwin Drood, and the same weekend is also the opening of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. We'll hear from Jennifer Sassaman in part two of today's program, but in part one, I'm really delighted to have on the program for the first time, I'm pretty sure, John McClay, who is an adjunct assistant professor of theater at Carthage College, where he teaches most of our acting classes, voice for the stage, theater for children, and he is the director, at least the stage director, I believe, of The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which is such an intriguing show. And I know many of the students who are in the cast, and they are tremendously excited, and I'm excited about this opportunity to learn more about this show from John McClay. John McClay, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Really, really happy to officially make your acquaintance, having heard your name so often, but life has not allowed us to meet until we are recording this interview. Ahead of us talking about The Mystery of Edwin Drood, maybe you could say a word about where you come from originally and the busy career that you have had and the busy professional life you have right now that includes Carthage, among several things.
Sure. Well, I'm originally from East Central Illinois, down in Champaign, Urbana. And when I was in high school, I had designs of being in musical theater. And I ended up, that's what brought me to Wisconsin. I was in the conservatory at Lawrence University up in Appleton. And then pretty quickly decided what I really wanted to do was classical theater. So I went off and got my MFA in classical acting. And started a life really working in Shakespeare.
And by the way, is that what that term means? Or what? I'm not sure I've ever heard that term, classical acting or classical theater. I mean, I'm not sure. I've heard it used in more vague terms, but I suspect in this context it means something more specific.
Yeah, certainly, you know, if you're doing, well, Shakespeare specifically for me, but even Moliere or the Greeks, there's just a different... you know, set of tools in your toolbox in those plays. I mean, acting is acting on some level, but a contemporary play just presents different challenges than a classical play where you're dealing with verse and heightened text and things like that. And so certainly we learned all things in school, but that was really my focus and passion. And somewhere along the line, I really became equally passionate about teaching it and working with young people in classical theater, and that eventually led me through a couple of twists and turns to First Stage in Milwaukee, which is really just the most phenomenal theater for young audiences I had ever encountered. So I've been there for about 13 years, and I've been teaching here at Carthage for, I think this is my eighth year here. So within the last 5 years, my career's taken a little bit of a turn as I've become a playwright. So I've got a side career adapting children's literature into plays and musicals. But, you know, all along the way, as I was working in classical theater, I kept getting drawn back to musical theater, which was really my roots. And I just love it. I mean, there are just some things that a musical can do that nothing else can do. So I'm really thrilled to be back working on one here.
And of course, this particular musical, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, is a bit out of the ordinary.
It's insane. It's just insane.
And what's interesting, too, is my acquaintance with The Mystery of Edwin Drood is pretty much limited to just a couple of its really wonderful songs where I've accompanied singers at the piano. And judging from those songs I've heard, I would never guess that the musical overall is as sort of outside the box as it is. The songs I've heard, I mean, again, just a couple of them are quite nice, but also quite conventional. But it sounds like there's nothing conventional about the overall show.
Well, that's true. So within this insane construct, which I'll talk about in a second, there's a lot of traditional music hall vaudeville review musical numbers, which go from, a quite beautiful duet or aria to a really madcap, wacky kick line chorus number. So as we go along, sometimes it's silly and sometimes it's serious. But the conceit of it is that, for those who don't know, The Mystery of Edwin Drood was the last novel written by Charles Dickens. And he was, as was the fashion of the time, delivering them to the public one chapter at a time. And before he finished the novel, he died. And he died right before revealing the solution to the mystery, who the murderer was. And as such, and never told anyone, there's no evidence, no one knows, as far as I know. I do not profess to be a Dickens scholar. And so the conceit of the show is that this late 19th century music hall review, this somewhat of a vaudeville musical presentation company, is going to present this show as a musical. And when they get to the moment when Dickens stopped writing, they're going to allow the audience to decide on several plot points, which also involve some casting and recasting. And so there are four different roles which will get assigned mid-show, and the actors won't know. So there are songs where the cast had to learn six versions. And then seven versions over there. I read recently that there are 500 different ways the show could end.
Mathematically.
Six versions of this and seven versions of this and 18 versions of this. And so it's really fun that way. And so there's a certain gonzo energy once we get to act two, and everyone just has to keep their wits about them because nobody actually knows how it's going to go.
We'll talk about the specifics of that in just a moment. I want you to say a word, if you would, about Rupert Holmes, who's responsible for creating this show. He's someone who I've actually interviewed on the morning show, although it was not about The Mystery of Edwin Drood. It was about some novel that he had just written. Huh. It was a really good novel, and this was many years ago, and I loved talking to him, and I should try to find that interview on a dusty old CD someplace. Really personable guy, and you could just tell he's just brimming with talent. As far as I know, this is the one and only show he's ever composed.
Well, he's got another one called Curtains.
Oh, he did that also?
Yeah, and
I didn't realize that.
And randomly, that was the other show I was strongly considering. It has nothing to do with Rupert Holmes. I was so I spend a lot of time in classical theater and children's theater, and so when I was offered the position to direct the musical, I thought, boy, I've really got to spend a year immersing myself in the musicals of the last 15 years, where I've been a little bit out of the loop. And these were two that really struck me. A friend of mine had directed The Mystery of Edwin Drood a few years ago, and I'm just struck by how smart it is. It walks such a great line of being, of honoring, an incredibly well-written, but also at times really melodramatic piece of literature, right? While incorporating this great homage to the music hall world, right, of the 19th century, while also just having a sense that the play also takes place now, right? Like our actors are now, and that sensibility and comedy. So I just think he's brilliant. I think he's so smart and so funny. What he asks of the company is really at times overwhelming, right? Like there's a moment, one of the reasons I wanted to do this show was I had no idea how we would make it great. There are just so many challenges and there's so many questions I didn't have answers to going into it. But, you know, you never know how you're going to cast a show until you get into the process. But sort of looking around the talent pool at Carthage, I thought, boy, we're going to have a lot of options for some of these really difficult roles. And so I think, you know, when you're a university or a college picking a show, there's always you're looking to hit on two things, I think. And one is what's going to be really curricularly valuable for the training of these artists, but also what is the story that you want to share with the community, right? Mm. Like you're also a producing organization in addition to a training organization.
Yeah.
And so for me, Rupert Holmes presents both, right? He presents something that is highly entertaining and a little silly. It's really fun. It's really funny, but it really is forcing our actors to stretch their chops, right, and take another step as artists. Hmm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with John McClay, who is with the theater faculty at Carthage College and the stage director for their main stage musical that opens this weekend. It's called The Mystery of Edwin Drood by Rupert Holmes, also responsible for the show Curtains, which I saw on Broadway. I can't believe I didn't notice. I hope I noticed at the time. If I noticed then, I forgot that he's also by Rupert Holmes. And
yeah, and I think Curtains was a collaboration that Rupert Holmes did with Candor and Ebb.
Oh, okay. So tell us a bit about the storyline of The Mystery of Edwin Drood. So is this, except for this matter of us not knowing the ending, is this a fairly standard sort of Dickens mystery?
Yes, right? So in this Victorian novel, the style of that, I would say absolutely. I think what we have in our musical is we have two plays happening at the same time, though. So we've got the Victorian novel by Charles Dickens, but on top of that, we watch right in front of us this theater company attempt to present this story with varying degrees of success and things going horribly wrong. So there is almost no fourth wall in this show. It opens with the chairman, who's really the head of the music hall, directly talking to the audience about, this is what we're going to do. We're going to try to do this show for us. And so at the heart of it, Edwin Drood, who in the play is played by a woman, a male impersonator working for the company, who's playing Edwin Drood, and her uncle of a very close age, John Jasper. And Edwin is betrothed for most of his life, arranged by parents to Rosa Budd. And something is off with John Jasper. There are some new people who've arrived to the community of Cloisterham. The landless brother and sister, Helena and Neville from Ceylon, which is what we now know as Sri Lanka. There's a reverend who's got an unknown backstory with Rosa's mother. There's just all sorts of characters who keep popping up as potential suspects that we aren't quite sure what to make of. So Dickens does a nice job of presenting a lot of options.
Yeah.
With one really obvious one, which makes him, of course, less obvious. He's too easy a choice. And then Edwin Drood disappears. I'm going to just give you that spoiler right now. And at some point, there's a question of, well, what's actually happened?
So logistically, explain how this matter is resolved in terms of the audience participating in resolving some of these questions. Logistically, how does that happen?
Well, sure. So the first question, we are simply going to introduce our candidates who will play the detective in our play for Act Two. And we will just go one at a time, and we will vote by the audience cheers. So the audience will literally applaud who they would like to play the role. And then that actor will run off stage and put on a costume. A costume that Kim Instinus, our costume designer, has created to be able to fit six different people. Because that's what it might need. Then when we get to the next choice, that one's a bit more complicated. And so we'll send our ensemble actually out into the house. We have pairs of ensemble members who are each assigned to a number of rows in the theater.
Okay.
And it's absolute mayhem. And they're just going to go through all the candidates. This will allow, too, the audience isn't going to know who's winning. So then they tally up the votes. They deliver them to the stage manager. The stage manager will then know who is playing the big part at the end. We don't tell the actors. The only people we tell are the orchestra and the stage manager so that they know, because it affects the music, because some of the songs are different.
Right.
And so the actors find out who's playing the big number at the end when it is said on stage. And then they instantly have to launch into a large musical number, which I just think is great.
And I suppose the audience knows that. That is explained to the audience that the actors only know this in the moment.
I don't know that it's completely clear. And we've played with what to do with that, but I think it's certainly going to be clear to the audience that what they're attempting to do is really, really insane. Then after that, we assign a couple of lovers. We have a love scene and love song at the end, and that's simply, again, voted for by applause in the audience. So the audience is going to pick a man and a woman who are going to end up together at the end of the play, and there are a couple dozen variations of that scene, and then they instantly have to do the new scene and the new song.
Do you have any idea if certain choices get made more often than others, or does it tend to be really quite random?
We haven't done it yet, right? And so I think we'll find out.
I meant historically, like
historically,
when this is
sure.
done. Are these the kind of choices where a given person will have some reason to choose one versus the other? Are these going to feel like extremely random choices that probably end up producing very random decisions?
There's two parts of that I'll answer. One is for the final choice of the murderer, I think it's pretty random. I feel like the most obvious choice, the one who the book really sets up to be it, was never, ever chosen on Broadway at any point.
Huh.
Not one time was he chosen. So Rupert Holmes actually gives elaborate instructions on what to do should that ever happen.
Right.
For the inspector, the detective, the script really does, I think, stack the deck in one character's favor. There's a character who's just begging throughout Act One to do more. And he's very charming and very fun. And so I think that character does get picked historically more than others, but not exclusively. And so the other thing that I think impacts the voting is if you go through, say, six people, here are the 1 through 6 candidates, six has an advantage over one. That as you're doing audience voting, the longer the voting goes, the more people get engaged, the more people are willing to vote, the more they realize they have to make a choice. And so one of the things we're doing just to make the actors' lives even harder is that when someone gets picked for that, the next night they move to the front of the line.
Ah.
So that we're changing the order of how we present the candidates, which means the actor who's describing them all can't know those lines in order. He just literally has to look at, all right, where are they standing? And then we'll say that. And I think, you know, one of the other advantages of that has come out in the play is they have to just be in the moment, right? And so, you know, I think one of the dangers of theater, something that creates deadly theater, is when it really feels practiced, right? When you realize, I mean, obviously we all know that it's been rehearsed and it's been practiced a million times, but, you know, theater is magical when the actors are so fully in the moment that, you know, we can suspend that disbelief and give over to it for a little bit. And so this play forces that. They have to be in the moment because it's actually not practiced, right? Or it's really under practiced, or someone has just changed it. So I think that's been a great education for a lot of these artists on just how to manage that.
What kind of a challenge has this represented for the actors to be prepared for all of these possibilities? And what kind of a challenge has it posed for you as the stage director in terms of rehearsing all these possibilities?
Sure. Well, I will say it's really worked out great. Like I can just say I love it. I love what these students are doing with this show. It's gorgeous. It's playful. It's smart. But that is only true because they came in really prepared. So one of the things we have at Carthage is we have a music department that really prepares these students musically before first rehearsal. So they really came in on top of their music. That helped. The other thing that we had was we just had students who I just told them right at the bat, you know, some of these things are going to be rehearsed less than you're used to. Right? And and they really took that and drove that. We had some moments where, for example, the lovers scene, which has, you know, a couple dozen versions-ish. So the question was, well, do they need to all be staged the same? Like if I have these two characters have this scene, and they're different scenes, and these two characters have this scene, are we helped? Is there a certain comfort in having just a similar physical pattern, right?
Yeah.
And or even, as I said to the students, I said, you know, it's not in the script that you don't tell the actors, that you surprise them on stage, but that's what they really wanted. Like, they wanted it to be harder. And so in working with the actors, it's been a little balance of, okay, in this scene where now it's you two instead of those two, what are the parts that we need to make unique to the two of you? And what are the parts that are just standard in the scene for everyone? And so, I mean, it's, frankly, it's just terrifying, right? Because the other thing that is unlike this show than anything I've ever directed is I just had no idea how to assess rehearsal time.
Right.
Because you can look at a play and say, oh, it's, you know, it's a standard 2.5 hour musical. But if you do everything that you could ever do, then it goes on forever.
Right, right.
And so how much time to balance all of that?
Right.
So
if you performed every conceivable choice in a performance, it'd be a Wagner opera.
Truly.
Or longer.
And even in rehearsals, so last night we had a nice run of the show. We added the orchestra. We added costumes. And we just randomly selected. I let someone in the orchestra make all the decisions. And so one actor got to play the inspector. The other ones did not. One actor got to play the murderer, and the others did not. And so there are a number of actors who are going to perform these roles at opening night that didn't even get to attempt them yesterday.
Wow.
They've just got to be ready to go all the time.
Fascinating. Well, I know lots of people are so excited, and every single student who is part of the cast is tremendously excited. And I'm impressed that I know you gave the actors at least one night off because I mean, some of them are in a music group of mine and we're thrilled and surprised, and so obviously you've done something right, if that was even possible with something as incredibly difficult as this.
Well, I it always comes down to the students. You know, one of the reasons there are a lot of reasons I wanted to do this show, and probably the main one is it's in my wheelhouse of what I thought I would be helpful teaching them in terms of the comedy and the bits and England, frankly, and the dialect and all that world. But really, it's them. It's the students, right? Like, this show is not one you'd pick for just anyone.
Right.
And, you know, and for a play that won the Tony for Best Musical, it doesn't get done very much. Like, I really wanted to go see a bunch of productions of it leading up to directing, and you just can't find them.
Well, there's probably a reason. It is a difficult undertaking, but it sounds like this is going to be just an exciting event in all the way around. So opening this weekend and running the following weekend as well, so April 28th through May 6th in the Wartburg Auditorium of Carthage College, The Mystery of Edwin Drood by Rupert Holmes. And you can go to carthage.edu/finearts/tickets find out how you can purchase tickets to enjoy this presentation. And the stage director, John McClay. John McClay, great to speak with you today. Thank you so much. I'm even more excited now about seeing The Mystery of Edwin Drood. Best wishes to you and your cast and crew.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for part two of today's morning show here on WGTD, I am excited to welcome into our studios Jennifer Sassaman, who is from the theater department at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And she is here to talk about the production that she has been helping prepare for and opening this weekend, namely Stephen Sondheim's early show, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, a crazy, wonderful show. And it sounds that like the cast and crew of at Parkside is having a wonderful time putting this together. Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum will be performed this weekend and the following weekend on the main stage of UW Parkside. And Jennifer Sassaman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Good to have you here. And of course, the last time there was a Sassaman here. It was your mother, or I don't. Is her name Sassaman? I can't.
Her name is Sassaman, Ginny Sassaman.
Right. So just remind our listeners of why your mother was on the morning show.
Well, my mom was here because she was leading a happiness workshop. She's the president of Gross National Happiness USA. So she was in town for her granddaughter's fifth birthday and decided to offer a workshop while she was here, so she could make it a working week as well.
Yeah. Well, it was great to meet her and fun to talk about happiness. And now let's talk about a funny thing happened on the way
Speaking
to the forum.
Of happiness.
Yes, right, exactly. First of all, I kind of characterize this as a crazy show, and I think that I mean that quite affectionately. I think highly of this show, but it really is something quite out of the ordinary. Explain to our listeners, first of all, where this comes kind of in the long and distinguished career of Stephen Sondheim.
Certainly. Well, Sondheim wasn't alone. He had two collaborators. Sondheim wrote the music and the lyrics, but the book was written by Larry Gelbart and Bert Shrieve Love. And what they, the three of them, did over the course of several years in the late 50s to early 60s was they read all of the extant plays of the comedic playwright Plautus, who wrote during the Roman Republic. They read all of his plays, which have survived through the many years because they were seen as being examples of spoken Latin. So even at times when theater was seen as something, you know, completely amoral, the plays were studied as a way to understand how people spoke in classical times. So we have a fair number of Plautus's plays, and we have 27. And so they read them, and they collected reoccurring themes and plot devices and shtick and stock characters, and they melded it all into a single musical comedy. So it's set, it's supposed to be in ancient Rome, round and about these three houses. So comedy, the way comedies worked in ancient Rome was it was on the street. All plays happened on the street in front of houses, and that and it was always three houses, and that fit with how Roman stages were built. So there were three doors built into the back wall, and so it was all happening on the street, and people would come in and go out and head off into town. And
so, and that, that wasn't in a sense fake. That was like actually where the story was taking place. Is that what you mean? Out on the street.
Out on the street. And it wasn't just like some of the plays did this. All of the comedic plays functioned this way.
Interesting. So tell us more about kind of the storyline then of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, this kind of mishmash. And as we watch it, does it sort of feel like a mishmash of various plots thrown together?
It doesn't. I feel like it seems together very well. The story is about, it's set in front of three houses. The house of a regular citizen, Senex, his wife and grown son. Next door is the house of a procurer, so it's basically a brothel. And that's the house of Marcus Lycus. And on the other side of Senex's house, it's another citizen's house, but he has been away for some time because his children were stolen in infancy by pirates. So he's been trying to track down his missing children for a long time. And the story, at the center of the story, is the slave, is one of the slaves in the house of Senex, who does not want to be a slave. Shocking. And he's very clever, he's very crafty, and he's trying to figure out a way to become free. He's tried to escape, he's tried to buy his freedom, and everybody keeps saying, this is not done, nobody does this, just accept your lot. And the grown son, the 18-year-old, or the 20-year-old son of Senex, whose name is Hero, has fallen madly in love with the woman he's seen on the balcony of the courtesan's house. And so he promises Pseudolus that Pseudolus can be free if he gets the girl. So Pseudolus is trying to figure out a way to make it so that Hero can marry this girl so he can be free. But the girl has been betrothed in marriage to a great captain who's coming that day to claim her in marriage. And so there are all sorts of complications. And
so the clock is ticking.
The clock is ticking. The stakes have been raised. The parents have left town to go visit their mother. And the other slave has been charged to keep Hero far away from the opposite sex. So there's just, there are all sorts of complications. It's very silly. I don't think I have ever laughed quite so much in a rehearsal process.
So is that central story roughly intact? I mean, for instance, the story of a slave wanting to be free, is that the subject matter of one of the comedies of Plautus?
You know, I have not read all of Plautus's comedies. I've read the Menachmi, which has some similar devices in it, but that's the central conflict is much closer to the show Comedy of Errors, and Two Gentlemen of Verona, this like set of twins being mistaken. So that's not happening, but there is the same level of marital strife between the, you know, Senex, the House of Senex, he and his wife are not on the best of terms. You know, she's something of a Herod. And so that plot device is being used. The older man who is chasing after as many pretty young girls as he can, that plot device is there. There's another play called Miles Gloriosus, who, and Miles Gloriosus is a character in this play. Mm. This is the captain, the great warrior. And in ancient Rome, there were these core values, you know, virtue and honor. And, you know, you were expected, if you were a man in Rome, you were expected to live by these standards. And Miles can't stop talking about how great he is.
Mm.
I am awesome. He's kind of like the Gaston character from Beauty and the Beast, if people are familiar with that. And so this idea of bragging about how amazing you are would have been seen as totally absurd in ancient Rome. So this is that's the comedy. So that play kind of gets built into this play.
Interesting. You know, it's so interesting to think about comedies in the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because the vast majority of anything we ever see depicted from that time and place, there's nothing funny about it whatsoever. And it's just kind of strange to think about the people of ancient times wanting to laugh, and yet it makes all the sense in the world. And in some ways, it brings that distant chapter of Western history to life somehow in a way when you think about them laughing.
Well, to be clear, Plautus lived during the Roman Republic, not during the Roman Empire.
Oh, later, right.
So he was living about the 3rd century BCE, living and writing. There weren't that many comedies or even dramas being produced under the empire. And that's not because they didn't want to laugh, but it was because their entertainment styles moved on to more of the spectacle. So the gladiator contest got really big, the Circus Maximus, the chariot racing. There were a lot of mimes and farces, and there's a lot of dance and, you know, some things that we might think of circus acts or vaudeville. It moved away from what we think of as conventional plays, as they would have been done in Athens, under the golden age of Greek drama and comedy. But it wasn't for lack of love of entertainment.
Right, just a different kind of a flavor of entertainment at that point.
Right, more like American Idol than out of Africa.
So no wonder they weren't laughing in the Roman Empire then, yes. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Jennifer Sassaman, and we're talking about Stephen Sondheim's A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, one of his earlier musicals, and it's going to be opening at the University of Wisconsin Parkside this weekend and the next. I appreciated how well you spelled out the rather complicated plot of the musical, and you were telling me before we went on the air that you have a cast of 18 and 10 understudies. So this is a big group of people, let alone not even acknowledging yet the crew and so on that are behind
team.
The scenes. So tell us about this matter of 10 understudies.
It's important to have understudies in case somebody gets injured or somebody gets sick, if something happens. I have a friend who went on for a big equity show in Philadelphia because the person he was understudying had to go to a funeral, and the plane, there was so much fog that they couldn't get back in time for the show. So you never know what might prevent an actor from going on. And fortunately, our company has grown to include so many talented musical theater students that we have, the room to do a full understudy cast as well. So it's exciting. And, you know, there have been cases where somebody, you know, couldn't get off of work or they had to leave town for a different performance and the understudy is right there and stepping into their place. So the rehearsal has not come to a grinding halt because we're missing somebody.
Right.
It's been wonderful.
Right. And you were saying that part of the point of this is to really equip your students for the way the professional world operates. And towards that end, I think you said you're going to have some kind of understudy run.
Yes, but that's not open to the public.
Right. But
the understudies we're calling it a stumble through. But in the professional world, in an equity theater, if you understudy a role, you are expected to go on at any point in time. And the way they gauge this is they have an understudy run where shortly after the play opens, I mean, obviously the main focus is getting the show up. But then once the show opens, the stage manager takes all the understudies and they do the play. They do it without costumes and they do it without lights, but they do move through the full play so that they have a sense that everybody's ready to go on. And I feel, different directors have handled this differently at our school, but I feel like I want them to be doing what they would be doing if they were fortunate enough to get hired as understudies at a professional theater, because that's a good way to, you know, build, to work towards your equity card. It's something that is a skill. Understudying is quite different from building an actual role yourself.
You were saying that when you get that whole cast on the stage of the main stage theater at Parkside, it actually is pretty crowded, and you've had to try to think in some innovative ways to just make room for everything and what they're doing. Just describe what the challenge has been.
Well, 18 people, that's a lot of bodies. And the main stage is large. And Keith Harris, who designed who is the scenic designer for the show, or the co-scenic designer, he worked with a student, Beth Albrecht, who is also co-scenic designer. They've come up with a gorgeous, extremely colorful set. And, you know, in some places, finding room for all 18 people. I mean, you can't do a regular kick line, you know, where people stand side by side, because there are too many of them. So finding ways to reposition, you know, I think that's kind of standard. You come up with the choreography. I'm the choreographer as well as the director. You come up with the choreography, and it's just you in a room, and you think, oh, well, surely, you know, I only take up this much space.
Right.
But then you get 18 people, and suddenly you have to come up with a different plan.
Wow. So I'm sure many of our listeners know the most famous song from the show, which is
Comedy Tonight.
Something appealing, something appalling. And it's just one of the greatest songs ever written. It is so amazing. But there is a lot more to enjoy in this score beyond that famous song. What are some of the other songs from this score that you think are especially noteworthy?
Well, before I talk about the specific songs, I feel like it's such an interesting point in Sondheim's career, because he was still quite young as a songwriter. And so I think he was still largely playing by the rules of what was expected of a composer during the golden age of Broadway musicals. But he's still Sondheim. So there are these brilliant tweaks in terms of, you know, I feel like future Sondheim music can get very difficult to play and sing.
Oh, yeah. Things like Into the Woods and Sunday
right.
in the Park with George.
Right.
Very intricate, sophisticated scores. And this is not really that.
It's
this
not there yet.
More
but
of
it's
the
still,
old school.
But it's not, you know, just sort of standard, easy music. There are some chords. There are some, like what the singer is singing versus what the orchestra is playing. It's challenging. It's
right.
challenging. And my favorite thing about Sondheim is the wordplay. And I feel like I'm going to embarrass myself here, because I can't remember whether it's Gilbert or Sullivan who did the words. But
Gilbert did the words.
But I also feel like when I listen to The Mikado or Pirates of Penzance, the wordplay is so smart and interesting. And, you know, so even something appealing, something appalling, like
right.
that's a tiny little thing, but it happens throughout the show. It's all so clever like that.
Absolutely. So this comes from, is it 1964 or 65?
62.
Oh, 62. It's even earlier than
yeah.
I remember. So, yes. So at that point, he's...
He's a baby.
Yeah, barely a composer. He's already written words for West Side Story
and
Gypsy.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, this is probably what really signaled to the world that he also knew how to compose music.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some songs that you especially like in this score?
Well, there's the song Everybody Ought to Have a Maid, which so Pseudolus has got the courtesan out of the house of Lycus, and she's spending time with Hero, but she's waiting for her captain to arrive. She is honor bound to go to the captain, even though she has fallen in love with this young man. And the father unexpectedly comes back from the country. And through, like, just random mischance, she winds up thinking that he is her captain. So she's all ready to go with him, and she just keeps saying, oh, I'm ever your servant, ever your servant. So Pseudolus gets the idea to tell Senex that she's the new maid. And Senex has the line, maids like me. I'm neat. I like maids. They're neat. And they sing this really bouncy song that's kind of, you know, like the sexual harassment anthem. It's very much like, it's so great to have these sexy young women dancing around the house. And so it's really bouncy. It's really catchy. And they actually do three versions of it because people keep showing up and seeing that the guy has come home. And they freak out. And Sudalis whispers, "No, it's a maid." And they say, "A maid." And then they start singing, "Everybody ought to have a maid." And, you know, this was something that I struggled with in advance when I was working on the analysis of the show before we went into rehearsal and production. There are some fairly outdated notions of sexual inequality that, you know, would have been totally fine in 1962, totally fine in 3rd century BCE, you know, like...
Not so fine now.
Not so fine now. And, you know, as a feminist and as the parent of a female human, there were some things that I found offensive just looking at the text. And at first I thought, you know, I want to make a statement and I want to combat this. But the more I read it, I felt like the show is funny and it's about making fun of everyone. It doesn't just make fun of archetypes of women. It also makes fun of the archetypes of men. So my solution was to play with the gender of casting and then also the orientation of those cast. So there are some parts that are written for men that I have played by women, like the great captain, this big macho captain played by a woman who's doing an amazing job. The wife of Senex, who's supposed to be this incredibly domineering, her name is Domina, older woman, and is like always trying to get her husband to, you know, be physical with her, and he doesn't want anything to do with her. I have that played by a man. So there are some parts written for men, played by women, some parts written for women, played by men. And then, you know, the courtesans, I really wanted to challenge. Initially, the costume designer and I had talked about challenging conventional notions of beauty and not just, you know, putting anybody in the part because they were, like, you know, slim and young and pretty. Unfortunately, we only have pretty people in our company. So, like, everybody's gorgeous to start with. But I did take – there's a role for – they're called the Gemini. So it's supposed to be – it's traditionally been, like, two tall, beautiful, blonde women. I have it with two men, and they're playing as men. They're not playing in drag, but they are sort of more on the spectrum of you know, there's a femininity to how – there's a femininity to their masculinity. And, you know, in ancient Rome, there weren't the same sorts of hang-ups about homosexuality that we have in today's world or that we had certainly when the play was written. And so – a brothel absolutely would have had beautiful young men as well as beautiful young women because they would have been catering to all the conventional tastes at the time. So I found, interestingly, once I switched up the genders, I was able to let go of what troubled me in terms of sexism because I feel like Roman comedy is rooted in the same thing that Commedia dell'arte is rooted in. This is all this notion of a telling farce where you put forth a stock character and every character has something, at least one thing that's not so great about them. I feel like we expect the hero to be someone we can admire and somebody that we can like see ourselves as. That was not something they were hung up in this world. You know, they made fun of everybody. Every character at some point looks ridiculous. And so instead of it seeming sexist to me, suddenly it was just like, oh, yeah, I've done that before.
Wow. Interesting. Well, I suspect you, at least most people are going to kind of see it that way. Nevertheless, it's good to sort of raise this issue being so when people walk in the door, they're not kind of blindsided by
this guy, we have, you know, very tall, broad-shouldered young man playing Domina.
Yeah.
And he's got a giant wig and drag queen makeup. I mean, he looks fabulous, but it's also funny.
Yeah.
You know, it's I felt like when I looked at the scene on paper, the comedy seemed to come from the fact that there was a woman in charge.
Yeah.
And that didn't seem funny to me.
Right.
But now that we've got this very powerful young actor storming across the stage, it's funny to me again.
Right. It's a Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum by Stephen Sondheim. There are performances this weekend and the following weekend on the main stage at UW Parkside. If people are interested in tickets, what do they do?
They can go to our website. UWParkside.edu or UWP.edu, and then you can go to the art section. And there's a link for tickets. They can come to the box office. So you can buy them online. You can call or you can come in person.
Very good. Sounds like a great show, and hope I'll get to enjoy it. And
I hope so, too.
Jennifer
Sassen, very funny.
The director of If Anything Happened on the Way to the Forum. Glad you could be here today on the morning show.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, James Hart, former husband of singer Carly Simon and the author of a wonderful memoir called Lucky Jim. And on Friday, pianist Pan Pan Wang, who's playing with the Kenosha Symphony, and will also preview for